Word today, just looking at the story of Jesus, this key moment in the life of Jesus, we'd like to begin by hearing three stories from our own community. And I think it'll become clear to you as we go through the passage why they've shared what they've shared. So let's have Dana start us off, then we'll have Jody and Dar.
Frank, it's a journey of like 77 times 7 conversions. So there's a lot to be said, and I'm happy to share any of those things. But I think really the best thing to do is kind of to start at the beginning. I became a Christian as an adult, and I feel in some ways kind of lucky about that because I came to faith like a totally blank slate. I had nothing, no church history, no background, no going to church, no like consciousness of the political, social, or cultural impact of the church or God's people or whatever, nothing. In fact, I never even read any scripture until after, well, not after, but as I was becoming a Christian. And then I dived in into a way that was really kind of profound. I joined this class that lasted 18 months, submerged in the Gospel of Mark. And it was like, it's like Christian 101 for me. I was leaning into it in a way that was really profound because I hadn't even answered the question yet of what it looked like to follow Jesus. So I had this. I had the Gospel of Mark. And I'm reading his stories and I'm reading his words and they're leaping off the page at me in such a profound way onto this very blank slate. And I was enthralled and quite determined to live a life that was worthy of the calling that had been not thrust upon me, but in some ways it didn't feel like there's a lot of choice in it. And, you know, so I didn't have any framework. So everything was being filled in by this gospel. And I was convinced that Jesus was this upside down person calling me to an upside down life, a radical life, a life for me that had two really important touchstones about justice. One was this determined downward mobility for all of my life. And the second was that my whole life would be given to service for the marginalized and for people who are oppressed. And it wasn't just that, though. I mean, that's a lot of work, work, work activism. But I felt like Jesus was saying to me that if I did this, if I walked with him this way, I would experience a special kind of companionship with him that I would not otherwise know. That it would be a deeper, more profound companionship, and I wanted that very much. But of course, you know, we're all works in process, and there was a lot to be worked out in me, to be frank. Like many of you, I struggled with the pull towards ideas about justice versus actually being in a place where people who need justice are. I struggled with materialism and comfort. But more than anything, I struggled with how deep and profound I had internalized white supremacy in my own life, and how that was perverting the picture of God's justice and my participation in it. And I think this last one became the biggest pull for me about a commitment specifically to racial justice. And over the years, I feel like that promise that Jesus gave me has been revealed to me. And it's been such a privilege to experience that. And the way that God has played it out has been very specific. When I was quite young, post 20, but, you know, young, I had this really amazing opportunity to pray with this woman who was like this mystic warrior in the guise of an African-American church lady, as they often are, I think. And that prayer time has imprinted itself on my mind and my heart for all of my life. To be frank, I don't remember a word that I said, though all of my words were prayed in earnest. But I do remember what she prayed. And it was pretty simple. It was Jesus. But not like that, because it was like honey. It was like, Jesus, I know I'm going to meet you today. Help me to treat you right. And it's that's been the key point, because we make sacred connections when we throw our lot in with those who are marginalized, when we draw near rather than stay at a distance. And it's there that I get to meet Jesus face to face. You know, and I make a ton of mistakes, so many mistakes, particularly out of that white privilege and white supremacy that still plagues me. But when I go to work, I work at the Y, or when I go to Men of Valor Academy, where our life group does ministry, I get to meet Jesus face to face, and I'm never disappointed. I'm never disappointed. And I find in those moments that something else happens that's really important, is that Jesus reminds me of my humanity, even as he allows me to see what is sacred in other people. And so I do. I pray that prayer. It's been the prayer of my daily walk. Jesus, I know I'm going to meet you today. Help me to treat you right.
So Gary asked me to share why in particular I really care about refugees and immigrants. So I work with refugees and immigrants. I've been doing this for a really long time. And I think, like many of us, we get involved and passionate about different issues or systems because of somebody we've met. And I think for me, I've met a ton of people, and I could tell stories for 3 hours, but I'll just tell you one. Was a Congolese family, and about 7 years ago, I was working with a refugee foster care program, and part of what I did was home studies for potential foster parents. And usually they looked like us, but occasionally we would get families who had taken in a family member. Kid's parents had died, and so they came here to the States with him, and we were in the process of certifying them. And as part of that process in California, it's pretty long. There's a home study, which is 8 hours in a different language, so it was even longer. But I had the privilege of meeting with this family, and I won't tell you the names. It's a lot of M's and W's and B's and K's. And it was a family, a mom and a dad, with 5 kids of their own, and this little, he was 8 at the time, 4-year-old that they had taken in when his parents were killed in front of him. And I got to hear their story. And you don't usually hear people's stories where they ask a lot of personal questions in home studies, which is kind of hard for someone cross-culturally. But I met with both the mom and the dad individually. And as part of their story, I was struck, and it still sits with me like 7 years later, of what they had gone through. And if you read the New York Times this morning, Nicholas Kristof has an article on the Congolese and the war in East Congo, and it's called The Capital of Rape and Torture. And that's what had happened to these people. They had been raped, they had been tortured, they had been raped and tortured in front of their children and separated and displaced, and ended up miraculously in a refugee camp altogether at different times. And as I listened to their story, I was so struck by how much faith, hope, and love they still had after everything that they had been through. And it just put a lot of perspective on the first world problems that we face, that I face, when I see these people who have gone through hell and back, and they still have faith, hope, and love, and they still come to the office smiling and caring for people who they have included in their family. And so I think part of why I love working with refugees and immigrants is because they remind me I am a foreigner. I have been a foreigner in this country and others. And I know what that's like. I know how it feels to be the stranger and how to feel like you don't belong, and to not have the people around you, the things that are comfortable, that make you feel secure. And every day I see these people. Every day I walk into the office and they are still smiling. And I feel like I need them as part of my discipleship, probably more than they need me. And so I think that's partly why I love working with refugees and immigrants. They keep me grounded. They remind me what really matters. And they inspire me. They encourage me. And I go home, think, you know what? My problems are not that bad. I think one of the verses that has really stuck with me is in Leviticus, and many of you know this verse. The foreigner residing among you must be treated as your native born. Love them as yourself. for you were foreigners in Egypt. And it's just embedded in the story of the people of Israel. They were foreigners. They were brought to a different land. Some of us are foreigners here. Some of us are native born. But there's a place where we have all felt like strangers, and we are called as the people of God to welcome those who are strangers among us.
Hi, my name is Darlene, and I'm here to talk about environmental justice. Like that. Look at that. It's awesome. All right, so a little bit about me. I would say that I was always into the environment. I started the environmental club at my high school in the 90s, which I was amazed that didn't exist already. I was like, really? Strange. So to me, that was a very logical sort of thing. Like, why would you use a styrofoam cup for 1 minute and it takes 500 years to decompose? So we got rid of the styrofoam that the school was serving in the cafeteria, that sort of thing. So there's a kind of logical, scientific side to environmental justice for me. But I would say the other side is very emotional and faith-based. And it was basically because of a missions trip I took to Guatemala sophomore year of college. And it wasn't even for the environment. It was, I think, a health pre-med sort of thing. But we were driving through these very rural, villages, and we would pass mountains of trash. I mean, hundreds of feet tall, exactly like if you can imagine the Berkeley Hills, but made out of trash. And on these mountains were full villages built out of trash, on the trash. And these villages had their houses, and they had little streets, and they had families walking around exactly like you would imagine any town. Children were running around barefoot. Whole families were out on their trash, collecting what they could eat or sell to make a living. Little kids, tiny toddlers, two-year-olds. It was a whole life, just like that. So I think that image has always stayed with me, and I think it will stay with me until I die, that we live in a privileged world where magical men take our trash away and we never have to think about it. But it exists. It's out there somewhere. Our waste is out there somewhere. And there's so much we can do to keep it as best as we can, recycled, reduced, reused. Because to me, it was God's creation in terms of earth and nature and what we're doing to our own planet, but God's creation as in people. We are poisoning our own people with our trash. So to me, that was an issue of injustice and poverty and oppression and lack that we don't necessarily always think of just in our daily lives. But for me, I feel it every time I put something in the trash can. So every ounce that I put in the trash can, I feel that. I think of that village. And that was only one village in one country. I've seen that in India. I've seen that in Belize. I've seen that everywhere else. So it is, to me, an act of faith to try to treat God's creation the way that he would have wanted. And I love technology, I love science, so I love innovation. If we can create these same products, but in a way that's, you know, compostable or biodegradable or whatever, like, let's do that. Let's do everything that we can to just save what we can.
And I know that we could multiply stories like these all morning, but we all have stories. And I think none of these stories make sense outside of the story that we're looking at this morning. Jesus' story of launching his own ministry, of launching a movement that we are all part of, that our stories are part of this very story here this morning. And so we have been faithfully going through the Gospel of Luke. It is our goal to read every single verse of the Gospel of Luke here in celebration, except for some of those names in the genealogies. But And here we have like I said, a key moment in Jesus' life and ministry. Until now, we've taken looks at Jesus that are very inward, right? That Jesus has been in the temple and he's like praying and he's like debating scripture with the other folks. And he's been in the desert and he's been resisting all these like offers for political power and the kingdoms of this world. And he's been, it's this wrestling with the devil in a spiritual way. And so now finally in this passage, we get Jesus making his first public appearance. In a sense, this is Jesus' inaugural address. And he actually did what politicians often do when they launch their candidacy for something. They go back to their hometowns, right? So last night I watched Obama launching his first presidency, and he went to Springfield, Illinois. It was very inspiring. It was like kind of warm fuzzies. And so here's Jesus, right? Here's Jesus saying like, hey, I'm the Messiah, and this is my platform. Jesus for president, right? This is, and unlike most politicians, Jesus is very clear about what he stands for and what his platform is. In some ways, Jesus would make a bad politician in America, which is probably a good thing, because you know exactly what he stands for. It's very clear from the beginning. And so as we look at this passage, Jesus is actually, in his Jewish context, he's going way back to Isaiah. And he is, in order to express his sort of party platform or his vision for the world or his role as the Messiah, however you want to put it, he reads this passage from Isaiah 61 and he throws in a little verse from Isaiah 58, which is what Roy led us in earlier. That's why he read it. And he says, look, this is my platform. This is what the kingdom, the upside down kingdom, this is what I'm proclaiming, this is what I'm leading, this is the movement I'm starting, this particular upside down kingdom, which is so different than anything else that's ever come before. Because who does it put on the top? It puts the poor, look at the verse, the poor, the imprisoned, the oppressed, and the disabled. It talks about blindness. And these are things, this is metaphorical, like, oh, it's spiritual blindness, oh, it's spiritual oppression. Yes, it is. But it's also political, physical, economic. It's all of these things. And what Jesus is saying is that the way of the world is that these people are on the bottom. And for Jesus, in his rule, as he is in charge, these people are on the top. That he wants policies, that he wants action, that he wants an ideology, that he wants a spirituality which makes the poor, the imprisoned, the oppressed, the disabled on top. And what did Jesus offer to them? He offered them good news. He offered them release. He offered them recovery. He offered them freedom and favor. And that's what he comes out saying, this is what I stand for. He's been in the desert. He's been connecting with Jesus. This does not flow out of some sort of political, spiritual kind of thing that he's just an activist or something. This comes out of this deep place with God after 30 years of being with God in the desert, out of his deep place of prayer, out of his deep connectedness with his Father. He's like, this is what God has me to be about. This is what the kingdom of God will look like in the world. And in fact, this upside down kingdom that he's talking about in this passage is very Jewish. It actually, this phrase, the very last phrase you see there, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, that's a reference to what the Old Testament calls the Jubilee. And the Jubilee was actually this whole big system. Here's kind of what it looks like. It's this whole political economy where there's a whole bunch more than this, but this is a few highlights, where every 3 years, and I love this, everyone dedicated 10% of their income to a huge party for people who didn't otherwise have access to big parties. And you're actually told to buy strong drink. We can talk about that more later. But anyway, it's this great thing just to provide for people to have a good time. And then, but that's just kind of the intro, right? That's like the warm-up band. And then every 7 years, there's this regular rhythm where slaves or servants, it's kind of the English word doesn't quite fit, but people who were in significant sort of economic distress and were beholden to somebody else, where they were freed, and they weren't just freed to get thrown out into the world to sink or swim, but they were actually empowered for entrepreneurship, or they were included in a family business where they belonged and had stock options, so to speak. I can give you the reference on that later. Every 7 years, all the debts in society were wiped clean. Every 7 years, and this is to Dar's point, every 7 years, the land itself got a Sabbath. The land itself got to rest. and God provided for people just from what naturally grew. Farms stopped, and the land itself got to be cared for. And then the granddaddy of them all was every 49 years, every 7/7, land ownership would get totally reset. Because we all know that what happens over time is some people get richer and some people get poorer, and those people with power use that power to increase their power, and you have a society that we're seeing today in the United States of an increase of inequality in the haves and the have-nots. And in the Jubilee, that couldn't happen because every 7 years there were these reset buttons, and then every 7/7 years there was a reset button where even the means of the ability to gain wealth was reset, and everybody got to go back to their ancestral inheritance, and there was a, in a sense, there was a renewing of the egalitarian valuing of every human life in that society, especially for those who were poor. They were the center, and so this is a very familiar Jewish idea that Jesus is calling out in this group, and what he actually said now. Did this actually happen? Not very faithfully, actually. Didn't happen that way. You know, as we know, Israel messed things up a lot. We all mess things up a lot. But it's always been the ideal. And so when Jesus in the temple that day, and I love the way it says, every eye was fastened on him. And he says, today, in your hearing, the Jubilee has come. And I am the Jubilee. The Spirit of God has anointed me. I am the Messiah who will bring this Jubilee. And as N.T. Wright says, that Jesus expected his followers to live by the Jubilee principle among themselves. There's a sense in which all the followers of Jesus would come together and live out this sense of justice for the oppressed in the way that the Jubilee had really talked about. And so how did this play to his hometown crowd? They loved it, man. It was great because these are Jews who are oppressed. They are oppressed by the Roman colonial powers. And so Jesus comes and he says, hey, Jubilee, all those places that you're enslaved or indebted or you've lost your land to some rich Roman landowner or whatever, here I am, baby. Yes, it's all going to happen. And so they just can't believe it. They're like, this hometown kid that we know, he says he has brought Jubilee to here to us this morning. And then this is where Jesus makes some very bad political moves. He comes in and he's very like aggressive and oppositional. He's actually like, yeah, well, you know what? Prophets are never respected in their hometown, and you don't really believe in what I'm talking about. And then he really gets offensive. And you might not have gotten, when Marguerite read it, you might not have felt the offense. But if you had been in the original audience that day, your blood would be boiling, I guarantee it. Because Jesus comes in and says, and you know that Jubilee thing? Well, actually, this Jubilee prioritizes people that you hate. It actually prioritizes your oppressors, these Gentiles. And he gives two examples from the Hebrew Bible of times in which God intervened for some foreigner, some oppressive outsider. It's, you know, the widow at Zarephath in Sidon. That's like foreign land. Those are Gentiles. That's Naaman the Syrian. They do not want to hear that Jubilee is also for the oppressive foreigners, and in this case, probably Greeks and Romans. So, of course, they respond by trying to throw Jesus off a cliff. They're filled with rage. There's a big, you know, UFC kind of crazy fight thing that goes on, and somehow Jesus passes through their midst and just walks away. So, a lot of drama in Jesus' opening inaugural statement. How does this speak to us? How does this fit with our stories? How does this lead to the stories that we heard from Jody and Dar and Dana? I think one way to think about this is how you might feel about roller coasters. When I was younger, I loved roller coasters, especially the ones that went upside down. That was sort of how I judged. Like, I grew up in Modesto, and so we would go to Great America in San Jose. And the best ones were especially the Demon, which would go upside down several times. So you can always tell which are the best rides by how much they go upside down, right? And I just loved it, I tell you. It was great. And my mom never went with us on these rides, and I could never figure out why. Until I myself got older, and something happens in your inner ear. And, right, I'm sure Judy or others could tell us why that happens. But you know, and where it used to be exciting, now it's just potential vomit. You know, it's just nausea and like, I don't want to spin around like that anymore. And so I actually feel like we have a little bit of that same ambivalence with Jesus's upside down kingdom. There's parts of us that really want it. Like, this is great, yeah. And there's parts of us that are kind of like Jesus' hometown folks, where you kind of want to throw Jesus off a cliff. This is not comfortable stuff. There's this mix and this match in it. And so how do we respond to this? And even if we've heard this invitation before, this morning, how do we respond to this? I think there are a couple of unhelpful ways, but very understandable ways that oftentimes when we read the scripture, one thing you can do is if you would identify more as a person of privilege. And of course, privilege and oppression are very complex things. We are made up of many different factors. We are gender, we are race, we are age, we are education, we are giftings, we are all these different things. But so if in those aspects, if those of us who feel like, actually, I feel more privileged, I actually feel like I'm on top, the idea that Jesus wants to turn things upside down and privilege other people than me, that can feel very threatening. And so I know that when people who feel more privileged, including myself, have read this passage, they often just spiritualize it away, right? They're like, yeah, those who are spiritually oppressed, Jesus has come to save me. Those who are spiritually poor, Jesus has come to bring new life. And actually, that is true. That is a true part of that passage. And when I came to faith at 16, that's how I met Jesus. I had no sense. I was very similar to Dana in the sense that I had no idea of white privilege or anything like that. All I knew is I was an unpopular kid that nobody liked, but Jesus loved me, and I was going to hold on to that. And that changed my life. Even though my family wasn't strong, Jesus met me in that. But to spiritualize that only and to not see the other aspects of the passage is not, you can't do that. Let me just say, you can't do that. Because that is the upside down kingdom that Jesus is calling us all into. And for those of you that would identify with privilege, we have this tremendous temptation to spiritualize it away, because then that removes the threat. That can remove the threat from us. I think for those of us that would identify, or aspects of ourselves, or that would identify more with oppression, this also is a hard passage, because that was Jesus' very own audience. And for Jesus to say, actually, the inclusiveness of my kingdom even includes these Gentiles that you want to exclude for good reason. But the inclusion of my kingdom, the upside-downness, even includes the oppressor. It even includes redemption for the oppressor. We all have reasons to feel like challenged by this upside-down call. And yet, at the same time, we are also like little kids who want that upside-down experience, because we know that there's something wrong with the world. And there is something about when you meet Jesus. Like, I love Dana's story talking about this blank slate. And she meets Jesus, and there's something in her that says, yeah, even though I'm more or less a person of privilege, I want this. I want a world where things are made right. And I'm willing to step into Jesus' kingdom. And we actually see this throughout the Gospel of Luke, as we'll see coming up. We see Jesus wrestling and inviting people, especially focusing on people like women who are especially oppressed in that culture and this culture, on poor people, on ethnic minorities, on colonized peoples, that Jesus had a special invitation to them. But he also had special invitations to people like Zacchaeus, who was an oppressor. And when he embraced Jesus' upside down kingdom, he sold half of what, he gave away half of his possessions. And what did Jesus say to him? Today salvation has come into this man's house. And so then you get this motley crew of Zacchaeus and some rich women and some former prostitutes and some zealots and some all these people. And Jesus says, this is now the beloved community. Welcome to the upside down kingdom. How are you feeling? And they're like, yeah, this, we want that. There's part of us that just, it doesn't make any sense, but we care. And I believe that that's what grace is. And I believe that as I look out on this room, that we have a lot of grace. And that part of what God's call for us is to reawaken that grace and to recenter that grace and to be called for us and to be called into the freedom, recovery, release, and favor that God has for us. When we actually care about people who have oppressed us, or we care for people who are oppressed but are separate from our own sphere of influence, we meet Jesus in that. We meet Jesus in a refugee from the Congo who has something to teach us. We meet Jesus in praying with someone who has something to teach us and whose words stick with us throughout the rest of our lives. When we meet people who live in Guatemala and we see the consequences of our own choices, and we care for the rest of our lives, it changes even the simple ways of whether we buy single-use boba straws or not. That's Jesus. That's the upside-down kingdom. And just to add to their stories a little bit, like, I think one thing that's especially strong for me right now is actually it's people that I probably will never meet. Those are people I'm thinking about a lot. Because I am thinking a lot about the world that I and my generation are handing off to my grandkids and to the generation of people who live in Bangladesh and Miami as the seas rise and cover their homes. And as they sort of ask, what kind of a world did I give them? As I, just through my own complicity of going through the world, burning fossil fuels, throwing out single-use plastics, all the things that I am doing as I just follow along with this system, what kind of a world am I giving to my own grandkids? And I love them, and Jesus loves them, and Jesus centers them. And that affects how I want to live my life now. And so that's why I think something like that over there is a small step towards walking into the underground kingdom. Underground, did I say that? Upside down kingdom. Wow. It happens. That's why I think like the men of valor orientation, which were happening right, it's happening right after the service, if you haven't heard about this. It's our opportunity to connect with men who have been formerly incarcerated and to stand in solidarity with them. If you have any interest in that during Munch Club, we're gonna meet over there in the library. Just take 20 minutes. If you don't know about that, but you might be interested, check it out. So the reason that I actually asked Jody and Dar and Dana to share is because I feel like there's a new energy in our church for living out the upside down, I said it right that time, the upside down kingdom, through these justice issues, especially through caring about, like, Jesus had this category of the poor, the oppressed, the incarcerated, the disabled, all these different things, and there's so much injustice in the world. But for us, I feel like what's really rising up for us as a church is a special concern for newcomers, people who are, like Jody said, who are new, who are immigrants, who are refugees, who have come here not for vacation, but for there's something that has forced them or pulled them to come here. How do we welcome them? That there's a special concern for people who have been incarcerated, especially because of racial injustice. There's a special concern for environmental justice and recognizing that our simple go-along-with-it kind of actions have a long and a big impact. So recently, a group of about 12 of us met. People who we feel like it's kind of a lot of us, it's our special call to care about justice stuff. In some ways, it's clear that all of us who care about the upside down kingdom, we all have a calling to justice. But for some of us, we have special time in our schedules to focus on these things. And so a group of 12 of us met, and it seems like these things are really coming up for our church. Like newcomers, racial justice, environmental justice, that I think there's something really coming in our church that we can continue to step into that. So as we get really practical, as we close here, I know that many of us have jobs which allow us to live out the values of the underground kingdom in those jobs. I know that many of us use our jobs, whatever they are, to take the money from that job to give into justice, to causes of justice. I know that many of us take time to just volunteer for issues that might be none of these three issues. These three issues are not the most important issues. They're not the only ones that are important. So I acknowledge those three things, but I also want to say that it's really important for us as a community, not just as individuals, to be able to model and live out this upside down kingdom together. And so that's why, as we think about the sort of 4-hour challenge, right? We say, like, let's actually not just believe in this theoretically. Oh, I believe in the upside down kingdom. Let's put our time where our mouth is. And so as we walk in to say, maybe I do want to give every other Wednesday night to volunteer doing tutoring over at Men of Valor. Maybe I do want to take some time to advocate politically in this upcoming election. Maybe I do want to take some time to think and act around reducing our plastic use or reducing climate change, whatever that is. I just want to say that there are more opportunities coming your way through our church. And if you want to talk and help plan any of these things, please come talk to me. I would love, this is an organic process where we're coming together. And I just think this is going to be more and more a deeper part of our DNA as a community together. Why is that? Because this is Jesus' manifesto. This is Jesus' action plan. The upside down kingdom that flows out of an inside out spirituality is what God is calling to. So let's just worship. Let's take some time to just worship in response to that. And let's just see how God would lead us. I think a main call for all this is that God releases God's grace to want to desire the upside down kingdom. This is not just another to-do kind of thing. That we want it as God releases. We worship, as we spend time in the desert, like Jesus did last week, we see this stuff rising up. And so as we worship, just listen to what God might say to you. And I also want to offer a special invitation to just receive prayer. After worship, after you've taken communion, we want to offer you a special time of prayer that you could receive by just going behind that screen right there. And if there's anything that God has spoken to you around release or freedom or recovery or favor, I'd love to pray with you around that. If there's anything related to your calendar that might have come up in response to this message, we'd love to pray for you around that. Someone also got this this picture of like a drop of watercolor paint just spreading on a piece of paper, and that's God's picture of God's upside down kingdom just spreading slowly through our collective lives. If those or anything else resonate with you, we just want to pray with you, because ultimately we want to grow together and live out this upside down kingdom together. Amen.